Sankte Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from Canto 10, chapter 64, verse 33. Naham hala halam manye. Naham hala halam manye. Visham yasya pratikriya. Visham yasya pratikriya. Ramaswami visham proktam. Ramaswami visham proktam.
Ramaswami visham proktam.
Nasya pati vidya bhuvi. Nasya pati vidya bhuvi. Naham hala halam manye. Visham yasya pati kriya. Ramaswami visham proktam. Nasya pati vidya bhuvi. The poison named Halahala, which Lord Shiva is famous for having drunk, without toxic effect. Manye, I consider. Visham, poison. Yasya, of which. Pratikriya, counteraction. Brahmaswam, a Brahmana's property. He, indeed. Visham, poison. Proktam, called. Na, not. Asya, for it. Prativiti, antidote. Bhuvi, in the world. Translation. I do not consider halahala to be real poison because it has an antidote. But a brahmana's property, when stolen, can truly be called poison, for it has no antidote in this world. Responsively, I do not consider halahala to be real poison.
I do not consider halahala to be real poison.
Because it has an antidote.
Because it has an
antidote. But a brahmana's property, when stolen,
can truly be called poison.
For it has no antidote in this world. So there's a very short purport. One who takes a brahmana's property thinking to enjoy it has actually taken the most deadly poison. That's all. So the chapter is called The Deliverance of King Nriga. And as we heard yesterday, King Nriga left the scene and went back to the heavenly planets, and Lord Krishna is speaking to the assembled associates around, but ultimately he is speaking to us, of course. And he's giving a row of instructions about Brahminical culture. And there's a few nice instructions. So first of all, here we hear about the property, that a brahmana's property is never ever to be taken by anybody who hasn't got the right to take it. And then we further hear also how A Brahmana should always be respected. Doesn't matter even if he curses you, mistreats you, even sinfully acts himself. He should always be respected. So that's quite a bit of a challenge to the mind. And also Krishna is saying, well, I'm setting the example of always bowing down to the Brahmanas, so this is how we should act. We should always bow down to the Brahmanas. So now in regards to the property, there's also Chanakya Pandit giving a nice verse, which Srila Prabhupada very often quotes in his lectures. And Chanakya Pandit, he actually was a Brahminical advisor to the king. And he was giving a very nice definition, what it means to be learned. And Prabhupada is commenting, so to be actually educated doesn't mean, you know, to go to university and study and know so many things. But actually, to be learned means three things. That first of all, one should see all women except one's wife as mother. That's what it means to be educated. To have actually that vision, not theoretically know about it and have heard about it, but actually truly have that realization and that vision. And Prabhupada comments, that's why we should always call women Madhujis. Even if they're very young, even if they theoretically could not even be our mother. But just to train ourselves to develop that vision and also to help the women to behave like mothers. So this is one very important aspect of Vaishnava culture or Brahminical culture. So that's one definition what Chanakya Pandit gives. But then the other one is that one sees another's property as garbage in the street. So that, you know, garbage in the street, who is interested in picking that up? Nobody. And that's the vision we should have about other person's properties. And Prabhupada gives that example. You know, you imagine there's some golden bracelet in the street. So everybody, you know, I mean, at least today, nobody would feel wrong to pick it up and say, well, obviously it doesn't belong to anybody, so now it's mine. But just the fact that it is there in the street doesn't mean actually that it doesn't belong to anybody. It still actually has an owner. And unfortunately, he just lost it. But that doesn't give us actually a right to pick it up. So strictly speaking, you're actually a thief if you pick it up, you know. And that educated vision that Chanakya Pandit gives means you would just leave it there. You would walk past and think, oh, how unfortunate, somebody lost it, but I'm sure the owner will come back sooner or later and he will pick it up. And Prabhupada further comments that in some, you know, I don't know how many years ago, a few hundred years ago, there was that law that whenever you take another person's property, you get chopped off your hand. So now out of fear of that, nobody would touch anything lying around, you know. They would be afraid, oh, if I pick it up, I'm actually a thief and I get the hand chopped off. So that's the vision of an educated person. And then the third point Chanakya Pandit gives is that one should treat all living entities as one wants to be treated oneself. So in other words, that also means that we see everybody equal and we don't distinguish, you know, between human being and animal and so on. But we simply treat everybody the way we want to be treated. So these three points, that's what it means to actually be educated, to be learned, to actually have those three realizations and to practice them, to live accordingly to them. So, and in regards to the property of leaving things in the street, even though they have lost their owner, but to actually see them as garbage, we can say these are more subtle aspects of being truthful. And as we all know, truthfulness is the last leg of religion. So, you know, to be truthful is extremely important. in our spiritual lives, truthful with ourselves and truthful with others. And we also get a similar instruction from that pastime with Bali Maharaj, where Bali Maharaj is promising these three steps of land, and then Sukracharya, he's trying to talk him out of it. He says, well, you know, don't you realize this little Brahmin at war is nobody else but Vishnu, and he's going to take everything away from you. So, and actually, Sukracharya is bringing up this argument. He's saying, actually, charity should be performed as long as they are good for our pious situation. So in this charity you're performing, this is not good for your pious situation. You will lose everything. So better you change your mind, you know, and you go back on this, and you've got the right to do it, because that's the principle of giving charity. So, but then Bali Maharaj says, no, how can I go back on my promise? I have made this promise to a brahmana, and I have to keep it. How can I be like just a normal cheetah, saying something and then taking it back? And that's ultimately the same what King Niga, you know, by unknowingly did, you know, giving something and taking back. So actually giving one's word to something, and we say, all right, we're going to do this, but then taking it back, it actually also means cheating, basically. You're giving something in charity verbally by making a promise or a statement, and then taking it back from the person you've given it. So it is actually the same thing, like, you know, giving something in charity and then taking it back, stealing it again. So in Bali Maharaj, he is saying that, you know, he is saying there's a nice verse where he says, I do not fear hell, poverty, an ocean of distress, fall down from my position, or even death itself, as much as I fear cheating a brahmana. This is what he's saying. You know, nothing is worse than that, cheating a brahmana. I'm not afraid of anything else, you know, even death itself and so on, but that is the greatest offense, cheating a brahmana. So how can I act like this, you know? And this is actually giving a very important instruction, because very often we don't live according to this, you know. We often say something, we make a statement, yes, I will do this. And then just because external situations change and things don't turn out the way we expected them, we think that gives us a right to say, oh, sorry, I can't do it anymore now, mm-hmm. You know. But actually, you know, Bali Maharaj could have said that. He could have said, well, somehow the situation changed here, you know. I only promised three normal steps of land here, and all of a sudden these steps, they become so huge. So this is not the way I was meant to give in charity, and I expected something different here. So he very easily could have said that, well, too bad, you know, now I can only give one step or two steps or whatever. You know, but no, the principle is, doesn't matter how the situation changes, doesn't matter whether we like it or not, whether it's favorable for us or not, we have to stick to our words and we have to fulfill our promise. Otherwise, we're actually cheating. Actually, it reminds me of one little incident where this came to my mind when a few months ago when I had my first chemotherapy treatment. I had to stay one night in the hospital because it's quite a heavy treatment. Your body gets full of poison, and sometimes your body immediately reacts, and so they always advise you first night you stay in the hospital. So my doctor, who was taking me through the whole thing, he was saying, so all right, you do the treatment, and in the evening I come and check up on you. And he said, it might be a little later, I have to go to a meeting, but I will come. So when I was there, you know, it was 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, he didn't come, you know, so I thought, he will not come, you know, and he probably will ring the nurse and will say, oh, is she all right? Yeah, she's all right. Okay, I've done my duty. So I took rest, but then 10:45, he came with a nurse, he woke me up, you know, and said, so, how are you, you know, and I said, God, it's so late, you know, I didn't think you would come. And he said, I am a man of my words. If I say something, I do it. You know, and I actually was impressed. I was thinking, wow, you know, I wish more devotees would live according to this principle, you know. I'm a man of my words. If I give my word, I will do it. Doesn't matter whether it's inconvenient for me, whether it's 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night, I'll do it. I've given my word, how can I not do it, you know? So we can get a very nice instruction from this that, yeah, this is actually also part of Brahminical culture. If we give our word and not do it, then we are cheaters. And how can we make advancement really with that cheating attitude, you know, since honesty is really the last leg of religion. So now, of course, we can ask, so why is this that this, you know, the Brahmana class is so respected? And of course, we know that the function of the Brahmanas are to be the head of society and to actually make sure that things are going in the right way and that their duty is to uphold religious principles. And I have collected a few nice statements about the Brahmanas, which I would like to read to you. Some interesting little points Prabhupada is making. From 6th canto, Prabhupada says in a purport, a Brahmana Grihastha may earn his livelihood by becoming a learned scholar and teaching people in general how to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although a Brahmana may sometimes accept charity, it is not for his personal maintenance, but for the worship of the deity. Thus, a Brahmana does not stock anything for his future use. So that's interesting, that actually even if a Brahmana is giving in charity, it is not meant even for his maintenance, but it is simply meant for the worship of the Supreme Lord. And then in another purport, Prabhupada says, a pure Brahmana voluntarily accepts a life of poverty and lives in the complete dependence on the mercy of the Lord. The conclusion is that although a Brahmana may receive much opulence from his disciples, he should not utilize the rewards of his priesthood for his personal benefit. He must use them for the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there we have again, same thing. So we can say that's why especially the property of a Brahmana, of course ultimately of everybody and ultimately also of every devotee, but especially of a Brahmana, is so kept in that position that you definitely cannot use it, because it's actually not even his. It is actually Krishna's. And that's why he has maybe some property, because he's using it only for the service of the Lord and nothing else. So that's why especially taking such kind of property gives a very heavy reaction, you know. And ultimately that same attitude should be there for a devotee. That's the principle, a devotee should live accordingly, that he only keeps whatever is necessary to keep body and soul together, and everything else should be used in the service of the Lord, for preaching, for worshipping the deity, serving the Vaishnavas, feeding them, and so on and so on. So that is one reason. And as Prabhupada is saying, yes, one has to live voluntarily poor. That's actually Brahminical life. Not being interested in stocking things for the future and for oneself and so on, but simply to live voluntarily poor, being satisfied with a minimum, and then using everything else in the service of the Lord. And then there is another interesting one. Let me see, when was that? Yeah. Prabhupada says, such brahmanas are meant to satisfy the Supreme Master, A brahmana is strictly prohibited from becoming a servant of anyone else, for that is the business of dogs and sudras. A dog must satisfy his master, but a brahmana does not have to satisfy anyone. He is simply meant to satisfy Krishna. That is the real qualification of a brahmana. So in other words, Prabhupada is pointing out that a brahmana, this is also what Vedavyasa Priya Maharaj was saying, a brahmana actually should not have a job, because as soon as he accepts a job, he accepts another master he has to please. So he's losing his brahminical position of having no other master except Krishna. So it means as soon as a brahmana accepts a job, some payment, there's that danger there, he has to compromise, because he's dependent on that master that he's getting the money. So as soon as you have some kind of dependence like that, you cannot speak anymore what might be necessary to be said, you cannot say. So that's why that is actually a important principle of brahminical culture, that a brahmana has to be independent from anyone, actually. Of course, spiritually independent is maybe something else, except spiritually dependent on senior devotees and so on. But I mainly mean now the material dependence, as soon as he receives payment, there's that change there, he becomes corrupt in some subtle way. And I actually often appreciate that point when I travel and make my humble efforts of preaching, that I'm not dependent on people paying my tickets, This is a very nice feeling. then you can actually really say what you feel has to be said. You don't have to compromise, not even in a most subtle way. You don't have to think, if I say this, then maybe they will not even pay my ticket anymore, I have to please them and flatter them and tell them how nice everything is or whatever, Otherwise they will think, was it worthwhile paying her ticket, So, very nice position, If you're not dependent, if you don't care, alright, if people give donations, great. And if not, no problem, Very, very nice feeling. Very nice feeling. Of course, if a person is very advanced, then he will not even compromise, even if somewhat he is dependent on people's donations and paying their tickets or whatever, But of course I'm not in that category. So I'm very glad always that, this dependence on money is not an issue for me, and I can pay, and I don't mind if people give donations or not. So then you have that brahminical aloofness, that independence, and you can simply see from a neutral point what does this yatra need in order to develop. So very, very important for a brahmana to keep that, And then there's also another nice little thing where Prabhupada says in a purport that's in the first canto, real intelligent men or qualified brahmanas never aspire for political posts. Also very important, because the position of a brahmana is to give advice. He's not interested in, getting the post himself. He's there to give advice, completely detached and aloof and neutral, simply having only that one master of serving and pleasing Krishna. That should be his only consideration, nothing else. He should be free from any kinds of, attachments and hankerings for power, for position and this and that. So, and the purport where Prabhupada is saying that is in connection with King Vena. When Vena was so, such a sinful king, and the brahmanas removed him, and then they churned Vena's body, and then they got Prithu Maharaj out of that, So, and there Prabhupada is saying, yes, if a king is, too irreligiously and sinfully ruling, then he should be removed by the brahmanas. But the brahmanas You know, they don't do that with that motivation, or let me get the post, you know. But they simply just do the needful. They do the needful. So, and in one sense, you know, we can say actually, you know, this function of the brahmanas, of giving neutral advice from an aloof position, this is a little bit neglected in this form. We haven't somehow managed to really apply that aspect of Brahminical culture and Vaishnav culture, you know, that we have these Brahminical advisors, you know. In fact, I have seen some temples in Europe where they have a Brahminical council, where they're trying to apply that, you know. They have a council of brahmanas who give advice to the managers, to the leaders. And this is actually a very important thing. I mean, this was Chanakya Pandit's role. He was giving such advice, and there's a whole, you know, a whole series of different verses Chanakya Pandit has developed, you know, some verses of wisdom and so on. So this is very important, because naturally, you know, especially for people who are more in a managerial position, very easy that our vision becomes a little clouded from certain goals and ambitions and attachments. I mean, we are not pure devotees, so as long as we have some attachments, our vision easily can be clouded. And then it is very helpful to actually have a Brahminical advisor who has no other interests except giving you advice and making things better, improving things, without wanting, you know, to jump on the post, you know. So naturally, what kind of king or leader can take shoulder of such kind of advisors who are simply only, you know, eager to get his position? So this is of course useless. But if we actually have some Brahminical personalities who are, you know, who have Brahminical qualities, who are actually detached and somewhat self-realized, at least to what Chanakya Pandit's definition is, that a person should see all women as mother and any property as garbage and treating everybody the way they want to be treated. You know, so if we actually have such kind of advisors, can be very, very helpful. Very, really can make things very nice. And it builds trusting relationships. I remember when I was in management in Latvia, there we had such a Brahminical council. We were trying to, you know, apply all these different aspects of Brahminical culture and Vaishnava culture in our leadership. So my ex-husband, he was temple president, and we had a temple council, and the temple president was basically just executing what all the department heads in the council were deciding. So if they didn't agree, then my ex-husband couldn't do it. And then apart from that, we had a Brahminical council who was just aloof of everything and who was just giving their Brahminical advice, you know, on things, you know. Even in things like regards to initiation, whether a person is qualified to get first initiation or second initiation, and so on. That was actually the duty of the Brahminical council, who had no, you know, no interest there in, you know, whatever, you know, because even in regards to initiation, sometimes it happens that simply, oh, we need some pujaris, okay, let's give some second initiations, you know, so we can, you know, have more people on the altar, you know, but that actually shouldn't be the criteria, you know. So, and then the Brahminical council steps in and says, oh, hang on, you know, this is maybe not the qualification, you know, to get Brahmin initiation. You know, and in that way there's a check and balance there. And you get some feedback. That's also a very important thing actually for any devotee, of wanting to get some feedback. Because after all we have that aspiration. We see ourselves as servant and we want to serve the devotees. So there's no more natural thing than wanting to hear, am I actually successful in serving the devotees? What can I improve? How can I change? Most natural thing, if we actually see ourselves as servant. You know, most natural thing. We want to know, what do you think about my service? You know, we are eager to improve it and please those who we are serving, you know. And even Ramchandra, he wanted to know, what are the people thinking in my kingdom, you know. And he took it very seriously, you know, and acted on it, you know. So this giving feedback, very important, and it actually creates trusting relationships, you know. It's like when I'm in Bangladesh, I sometimes give these little seminars to the leading devotees, to the temple presidents and senior devotees. And last time we did that, you know, we had some interactive session where we were giving feedback to each other. And there's this nice management and leadership course by Anuta Mahaprabhu, Prabhupada Sapa, and he gives them usually in Mayapur. So he gave me his materials to do the course better, you know. And there's one section about this importance of feedback. And he's describing we can give feedback by asking three questions. So we ask the people who we are serving, we ask them, what would you like me to continue doing that I am already doing? So that's positive, you know. What do you think I'm doing nice? What do you appreciate in my service? So what do you want me to continue doing that I'm already doing? Question number one. Then question number two is, what would you like me to stop doing that I'm doing? So that's something negative. What don't you like? What do you want me to stop? And then third question is, what would you like me to start doing that I'm not doing yet? So in other words, how can I improve? You know? Very nice. And that gives some feedback, you know, and gives us an own assessment, because we ourselves, very difficult to assess ourselves, how we are doing, you know, because we see ourselves very different than other people see us, you know, and it's in our own interest to hear, how do other people see us? Are they satisfied? You know, even business companies do that, you know, they give out these forms, you know, give us your feedback. Even the hospital where I'm getting the treatments, they always bombard me with these forms. Please fill it in, you know. How is our staff? How is this? How is that? You know, you have to tick all the different boxes there and so on and value their service, you know. So a very important thing. So, and the important thing with the feedback is that we don't talk about the person's character. We don't say, oh, you know, stop being angry and this and that, you know. Not character, but towards activities. And if a person tries to improve his activities, he automatically improves his character. You see, so character and activities, of course, are very closely linked. So just by endeavoring to act differently or to start things or to stop certain activities, that automatically has an effect on the character, you know. So we don't give feedback on the personality as such, but simply on his action. And it's very nice. And it is part of that whole Brahminical culture, you see, of having this Brahmana advisors. And we can say not only in regards to, you know, the king needing Brahminical advisors, but actually every devotee needs that kind of Brahminical advisor in order to help him progress. So that's, you know, that's what the whole counselor system is about. The film I want to show you on Sunday morning and Tuesday evening about this Chaupati temple, because they are trying to apply these Brahminical aspects in their community, and it has very wonderful results. And one of them is this principle that we all need a Brahminical advisor who is neutral, who has no other interest except helping us in our spiritual life. No financial interest, no managerial interest, no nothing. Simply just neutral, from a neutral point of view. I remember once Radhanaswami, he was saying this in a lecture, he was saying, Actually, a devotee's development is very much dependent on this good fortune, whether he has this good fortune of finding such a well-wisher who has no other interest except helping him in his spiritual life. This is what it means to actually get the mercy of a devotee. This is what it means. No other interest, simply just trying to help you balance your spiritual life, that it is healthy and balanced, and you can actually make steadily progress. And this, I strongly feel, this is something we have really neglected in ISKCON worldwide. You know, wherever I go, I'm always seeing this, that this is actually what is lacking. This is why so many devotees come and so many devotees leave. Because it is an ongoing process. We have to, in an ongoing way, we have to nurture and nourish devotees in their spiritual life and help them to actually apply the process properly. You know, but very often we have this understanding, yes, now he is a devotee, so now we don't have to worry about him anymore. He is already a devotee, so let's get him to serve this, that, you know. And we just simply neglect to actually give people that guidance, that nourishment, that inspiration. It's an ongoing process. And I strongly feel this is why we have not managed to actually create this Brahminical society, you know, within ISKCON, who actually is so mature and so has all these Brahminical qualities, you know, because it is an ongoing process, gradual process. It doesn't happen just by giving somebody Brahman and you know, getting him to preach or give class or serve the deities or something. No, there's much more to it, you know, much more. And that's why Prabhupada was saying that preaching to devotees is more important than preaching to non-devotees. That's why he was saying that. There's also one very nice thing, so now where do I have it? A famous quote in a letter where Prabhupada is talking about boiling the milk. You probably know it, huh? Let me see if I find it, because very often we simply think in terms of increasing numbers. You know, we think, yes, our preaching shows success if we increase in numbers. You know, we get more people to come and so on and so on. But this is not necessarily success. Success is, you know, Prabhupada often says, we don't want many stars, but we want one moon, you know. So in one letter to Rupa Nuga in 72, he said, another devotee is quoting that. It says, we may sometimes hear that Srila Prabhupada at one point wanted that the expansion of ISKCON stop, and that we, as he himself said, boil the milk. In 1972, Srila Prabhupada said, now I want that we shall concentrate on making our devotees Krishna conscious and ourselves becoming Krishna conscious and not be so much concerned with expanding ourselves widely but without any spiritual content. Just like boiling the milk, it becomes thicker and sweeter. Now do like that, boil the milk. Very nice. So this is exactly the principle of this counselor system. You know, it facilitates this necessity of boiling the milk, making making devotees more solid and more sweet, like burfi, more solid, more sweet. And as we all know, to make burfi is quite an effort. You know, you stand there for quite some time. You know, so this is basically what it means. And also, there's this other saying, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was saying, you know, to actually make one devotee a pure devotee takes 300 gallons of blood. So, you know, it actually takes a big sacrifice. So, you know, who's going to shed this 300 gallons of blood for every single person? We can't expect that the guru sheds that, you know. For each of his disciples, 300 gallons, you know. He simply doesn't have that blood, you know. So that means we all have to contribute, you know, at least we all have to shed a few drops of blood in order to help one devotee to actually become a pure devotee. So it's a self-sacrifice, you know, and that's really what this council system means, you know. It helps devotees to achieve that brahminical qualities of reaching out to others and helping them in a selfless way and being very exemplary. And it helps the others to come up and have some shelter, some guidance, some support in their spiritual life, which comes from a neutral position. You see, it's basically the principle of Vaishnava association, giving shelter, accepting shelter. It's nothing artificial, like Prabhupada always says about chanting the holy name. It's not an artificial imposition on the mind, right? We all know that, he says that on that tape. So same thing we can say about the council system. It's not an artificial imposition. It's the most natural thing. Giving shelter, accepting shelter. This is principle of brahminical culture, of Vaishnav culture, you see. In fact, there's one other nice little thing which I found which really gives the essence of this counselor system, of this need for this shelter. It's a verse from the Garuda Purana. It says, one cannot be liberated without association of a pure devotee of the Lord. And unless one shows mercy to those in an inferior position, one's life will be superficial. And this is so true, you know, if you think about it. Unless one develops that compassion, that selfless mood of serving a devotee and trying to help him in his progress, unless we develop that, our life is actually superficial. All we're worrying about is ourselves, our own advancement, our own situation, our own purity, and it's actually superficial, you know. But we really develop as a deeper devotee when we have that mood of wanting to serve others and help them in their Krishna conscious way, in their Krishna conscious life. So this really gives the basis for this counselor system. Yes, one cannot be liberated without association of pure devotee of the Lord. And that doesn't only mean the Diksha Guru. It simply is not enough. That's the point. How often do we see our Guru? A few days a year, you know. But some might not even have the possibility to speak to him much personally, you know. It simply is not enough. And also our Gurus have so many disciples all over the world. They travel so fast. Very often for them, very difficult to actually assess the actual situation of each and every devotee. Very difficult. Because also when Guru comes to the temple, things look completely different, you know. Then everybody's in ecstasy, everybody's there at the program. And you actually get the wrong picture. You know, you don't know what life is like when Gurus are not there, you know. Actually, you know, Niranjan Swami, he always says that to me, you know, because I'm traveling in Ukraine and he asks me always to write him reports about each temple I'm visiting. And he's saying, you can see so much more than I can see. You know, and that's really what it's like. You know, when Gurus come, not so easy for them to really see deeper, you know. But, you know, if somebody like me comes, there's not all this fuss going on, and then I can see more deeply what's really going on, you know. So he always says, you know, your reports are so valuable to me, and he follows up, you know, whatever I report to him. So it's very nice cooperation. And then you can actually really do something. You can really help yatras and devotees if there's that cooperation between all different levels, you know. Then you feel you actually, you know, you're able to render some service, you know, because often I naturally need, you know, the gurus and GBCs to follow up on what I can see, you know. I don't have that potency to change things or something, you know. So in that way, you know, again, it's part of this brahminical culture, you know, to have advisors on all different levels for the benefit of the whole goal of actually coming closer to Krishna, really, you know. Yeah, so in that way, you know, I strongly feel this is one thing we have really neglected in ISKCON, and this, and those yatras where I am mainly traveling and serving, which is Bangladesh and Ukraine, there we are trying to apply this. We are trying to extract, you know, the basic principles from this Chaupati model. And we are trying to apply it, and immediately we see, yes, it makes things nicer, it improves things, it creates trusting relationships, affectionate relationships, and everything is really based on that, you know. And it really improves things very much, and it helps us to apply this Brahminical culture in our lives. So I'll finish there, time is going on. So maybe somebody has some comments, some questions.
Thank you very much, Devi Mataji, for a very nice relationship, because that's the most important thing. Otherwise, what happens? If we get power, we get power corrupt, and then we start victimization. So that's a very important fact what you're saying. And Prabhupada's principle, like boiling the milk, very, very important. Any decision, if I can't take any authority, it is best to keep advisors, maybe 5 advisors, and then you can preside on the meeting, and then decide, because each and every devotee is very important. We cannot victimize any particular devotee because of our position. That's a very important lesson you have given. Mm-hmm. That shows introspective being a thing. Because Lord Krishna is taking the heart. He is watching each and everything. We can cheat everybody but not Krishna. So we have to have an introspective idea also. That we sometimes think that 4 equity principles and 16 norms, that's enough. It is enough. Prabhupada says. But Prabhupada is saying this also. What you are highlighting today.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. Because it's very, very important thing. Each and every living entity is so important. Even in our behavior and the temple also. We have to be very, very careful that we don't hurt anybody's feeling. Because if you don't hurt somebody's feeling, you have got it yet. Even your spiritual master cannot see you. So we have to be very, very cautious when dealing with
this. What if he's doing the wrong thing? The girl is not doing something correctly. I don't say anything to him because I don't want to hurt his feelings.
That's it.
Yeah, it has to be balanced. I mean, I hope you will have some interest in watching this Chaupati film, you know, because Radha Swami gives a lot of nice principles in there, and one of these principles is also that he's saying exactly that, that every member of the community has to feel appreciated and wanted, and then people want to serve, you know. And this is also one thing that Niranjan Swami always says. He says, if people don't come forward to serve or give support financially or in service, it means we are not giving them enough. Otherwise, they would want to serve. So it means somehow or other we don't give them enough Krishna. Otherwise, they would want to serve, you know. And in Chaupati, this is really going on. People are so eager to serve. I mean, it was quite amazing. Like, I had the surgery in Bhaktivedanta Hospital. So my surgeon, he was Brahmin-initiated devotee of Radha Swami. So and he is such a busy man, you know. He works in several hospitals, you know. His day goes from 7 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, just taking care of his patients, you know. But then every Sunday evening, he travels all the way from Bhaktivedanta Hospital to Chaupati, which is about 1.5 hours drive, in order to dress the deities in the evening. I was impressed. I was thinking, wow, you know, isn't that amazing? So, and then he once said to me, he said, actually, there's a whole queue of devotees waiting to serve the deities. And he laughingly added, he said, I'm sure some of those devotees, they're hoping that I'm giving up my service so they can get it, but I'm not going to give it up. So this is the eagerness Yeah, right? They have. And this is what Ramaswamy always is saying. If a devotee feels protected and sheltered, then he wants to surrender. He wants to give his life. And of course, we can say ultimately Krishna is giving us shelter and protection. He is the ultimate shelter and protection. But then ultimately we have to say, well, Krishna is a little remote for most of us. So we need somebody in between there, you know, who actually gives us on a more daily basis that feeling of being sheltered and protected and valued and appreciated. Otherwise, how can we surrender? A person actually cannot do the service with a devotional attitude and with that mood of really wanting to give everything if he has no shelter, if he doesn't feel sheltered and appreciated and supported. You cannot surrender, you see? And just that philosophy of knowing, yes, Krishna gives the ultimate shelter, doesn't work in our neophyte stage. We need somebody who gives us that shelter so we can surrender. And as we surrender, we will also realize more and more Krishna's shelter. But without that surrendering, we will not be able to come to that point where we actually perceive Krishna as the ultimate shelter and protection. That Krishna only shows us as we surrender. So it's kind of like a vicious circle. You're getting caught in a vicious circle there, you know. Because you don't have that feeling of being sheltered, you cannot surrender. And because you cannot surrender, you cannot understand that Krishna actually is the main shelter. So in order to actually perceive Krishna as being the main shelter, you need that shelter in between. And then gradually you can surrender more and more and more. And then you perceive Krishna as being the ultimate shelter. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. I'll just see if there's time. I'll ask one. In terms of independence of the Brahminical Council, who decides who gets to be on the council?
Who gets on the council?
How is that decided? Who appoints the Brahmins to the council?
Well, I mean, it's the same. You can ask the same question in the council system. Who decides who is a councillor? Right? So that is decided by high authority, you know, by temple president, by GVCs, you know. Because naturally those persons have to be qualified, you know. Even as counselor, you know, to some devotees I gave that book, Taking Care of Krishna's Devotee. You're from Brisbane, right? Yeah, I'm planning to visit there and I'll come with some books. So. Yeah, hang on, I haven't answered this question yet. So, you know, the counselors or, you know, the Brahminic counselor, they have to have certain qualifications, you know. Like even for being a counselor, you have to be non-political. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't be, you know, a political person, you know, creating some political, you know, conflicts there, or, you know, you have to have that, you know, those qualities which I was reading, that a Brahmana is never eager for political posts, you know. He is not eager for power, position, this and that, no. You know, so they have to be qualified, you know. Otherwise it doesn't work. Otherwise you just have some Brahminical council who's just always nagging and complaining and blah, and who want to often obstruct things then out of their own personal ambitions or whatever, you know. So then it doesn't work, you know. So one has to be qualified, you know. But these things are a challenge, you know. They actually help us to become qualified, you know. In a similar way, it's like a parent who has got a child, you know, of having to set a good example and being responsible for some other living entity. It helps, you know, to actually, you know, do the right thing and grow up and have good behavior and so on and so forth, you know. In the same way, like the young devotees also help the senior devotees to actually behave properly because they feel their duty. I have to, you know, be inspiring to them and set a good example and so on and so on, you know. So it's all helpful, you know, to actually come to that qualification. Anirudha Prabhu. I mean, as I was describing, it is part of the Brahminical culture. And basically, the unfortunate thing is that especially we Western devotees, we haven't developed it, you know. And that's why they are difficulties. So, but like, for example, in Bangladesh, where I'm also spending quite a bit of time, that is a place where people naturally have, you know, some Brahminical culture, Vaishnava culture, it's in their blood. You see, and there you don't necessarily need so much that format, you know, because it is already automatically going on in an unorganized and informal way. And you can see that even about our Indian congregation here, that there it is also going on. They have that idea, yes, the senior devotees I should be respecting, I should take shelter of them, I offer them service, and the senior devotees feel, yes, these young devotees, we have to look after them, we have to take care of them, we preach to them, we help them with their living facilities and this and that. So they're in an informal way, it is all going on, and that's why they are so active, you know, but the Australian devotees haven't got that. And I mean, I'm always trying to analyze what is the root? Why aren't they coming? You know, why aren't they active? There must be something that we're doing wrong. You know, so many devotees have been made in the past, but they're not around. They're not active. And my analysis, I mean, my humble opinion is that this culture, you know, the Western devotees are too rooted in materialistic culture. That's the problem. And materialistic culture means it doesn't facilitate spiritual advancement. It goes opposite. You see? So, and according to my understanding, this was one reason why Prabhupada was recommending that devotees should spend time in India, you know, to imbibe that spiritual culture a little bit more and apply it in their life, you know. And so, you know, to come back to your question, on one hand, we can say, no, it's not absolutely necessary for the development of a yatra. But then, it is nothing artificial. It's a basic principle of Vaishnava association, giving shelter, accepting shelter, associating on that basis of Shravanam Kirtanam, getting together, discussing different points about spiritual life, chanting the holy name together. I mean, it's not happening amongst the Western devotees. So obviously, they need a bit of help. And this council system gives it. I've experienced it in Ukraine, you know. I'm going there for 8 years. And Ranjaswami is a very strong, you know, preacher of this counselor system, you know. It's his mission. That's why he wrote a book about it, you know. And I can see in those yatras where we apply it, it immediately has a good result. It has a good result. It brings the devotees together on that basis of Shravanam Kirtanam. It helps them develop trusting relationships. You know, it helps, even in very small yatras. I mean, Ukraine, some temples, they have only 10 initiated devotees, you know, but still they apply the principle because it's nothing artificial. It's simply associating on Vaishnava principles, and you get the result. Everything becomes nicer. You know, so... Well, it's...
There are other ways. It's the other ways is, because I have to be honest with you, I'm becoming very discouraged. I just feel like you're shoving it down my throat.
No.
This is how I feel. If you want to do the feedback, I'll give it to you.
Yeah, all right.
You know, it's almost like if you don't do the council system, then you're not going to be successful in looking after the devotees. And I believe that there are other ways of building devotees within Islam. You don't have to do it in a cookie cutter fashion.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sorry if I, you know, come across like this.
Well,
you know.
Yeah,
I am.
You're coming into a community of devotees that actually is very supportive. The devotees are very enthusiastic about doing devotional service. We have Bhakti Shastri classes, we have Bhakti Mai Bhava classes. The devotees do come together regularly to hear and chant. There are devotees who naturally leave the community and are sheltered to the devotees. It's happening. So, you know, it doesn't have to be done in a particular way. It can happen naturally without there being some institutionalized system for looking after the devotees.
Mm.
Because it is culture. One thing Islam has is a very strong culture. In fact, we're somewhat weak organizationally. But we actually have a strong culture, especially in this community. The culture is to look after the devotees. So, you know, when somebody comes along and it starts telling you, you should do it this way, you should do it that way, you've got to do it like this. If you don't do it like this, then you're not going to be successful. Then what somebody like myself does is, oh, no, what's going on here? We've been told to, you know, do everything completely differently than what we're doing now because we're not going to be successful. Well, I don't accept that. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody says you can't be successful, I say, I'm sorry, we're already successful in a little way, in a little bit. We're already trying to pour down the milk. That's why we've got brahmacharis. We've got dust holders. They're studying Prabhupada's books systematically. They come together and we have kirtan. They come together and have festivals. In fact, that is our culture. Isn't it? Isn't that what Islam's all about? Isn't that what we're doing? So, I mean, I'm sorry, but I after being back, you know, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. I have to say, why? Why do I have to change?
Well, if you want to get a different result, there's one thing I think Marshall Goldsmith, he says, what brought you here won't take you further. Because what we've done, I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with this idea, but just in an abstract way, this is definitely the most successful temple in Australia. I've been to all of them. Actually, I'd say it's the only one. I wouldn't say that anywhere else. But this is, this is the most successful temple in Australia. But then to do something further, wouldn't you have to do something different? To take it to the next level, wouldn't you need to do something additional? Or?
Maybe, but I have some arguments about that. We are a small community. Chalpati is a very big community. They have distance constraints. One of the reasons why they have a council system is because not all of the devotees can actually come to the temple and associate together. It's too hard in Mumbai. Try travelling, you know, more than 10 kilometres in less than an hour. You just can't do it. In Melbourne, you can get to the temple from 40 kilometres away within 30 minutes. You know, it's just so much easier. But we don't have the quantity of devotees. Right? And you know, we're already attracting hundreds of Indian community members, right? They're gradually building into a restaurant community. We're also preaching to the Western community. And one of the reasons why we make less devotees in the Western community is because it's harder. It is much harder. You know yourself.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not because of any structural fault that we're not making devotees within that community. It just takes longer and it takes time. So you can have a fantastic structure, but that won't speed up people, you know, coming to Christian consciousness from the Western community.
There are successful examples elsewhere, like in New Zealand, for example. Many, like,
It's slower. My argument is, from your point, how do you select the councillors? The councillors almost naturally select themselves in a small community like ours because they become the leaders. They're the natural leaders. And people will naturally gravitate to those people who show the most aptitude for sheltering and, you know, actually looking after people. That's what happens. But, I resist any appointments or whatever, because I generally like to see them develop and naturally, you know, manifest. If there's problems, I'll intervene, but otherwise I just let it go. You know what I mean? Just let it grow naturally, because a lot of it does depend on people rather than systems. Right? So, anyway, I'm sorry, I I do get the feeling that I've been told you've got to have a counselor system, you've got to have a counselor system, you don't have a counselor system and you're not going to be successful. That's the message that I got. And I'm resisting it. Quite openly. I don't mind suggestions for improvements on how we can improve our current system. No problem, but to be told, you're not going to be successful if you don't have this. So I just thought, I can't make it anymore. I'm out. I get in. Well, I protest. So because I'm the kind of person that I am, I'm certainly happy to improve things or whatever. But I would prefer to do it building on what we already have, rather than saying you've got to have a whole new system. Because here's what happens with that, you know, I know what happens. There's about to say, hey, anywhere, the market knows what we should be doing. How do I do it on the order? No, seriously, it happens in Islam like that. So I'm saying, I appreciate, see, and here, I know Achyuta Priya, and I know they have a lot of devotees in Ukraine. A lot more than we have.
Not really.
Well, but they do have quite a certain
I traveled for 7 years all around Ukraine, you know, and I do know the yatras. As I said, we apply the principle even in yatras where there's only 10 initiated devotees and just, you know, 30 people coming for the Sunday program or something, you know, because it is nothing artificial. That's the point, you know. So, I mean, I'm really sorry, you know, if you feel steamrolled or whatever. This was not my intention. And I'm not even, you know, I don't even think you will apply it here because it actually is not so easy, you know. It needs people who really are convinced about it, you know. But my intention basically is to talk about it and to show you the film just to raise the awareness of the need of actually taking care of devotees in a more balanced and wholesome way. That's actually my whole idea, because I do feel it can be improved, you know. All right, it might already to some extent be somehow in an unorganized fashion there, but it can be improved. It can be improved, you know. And the result shows, you know. So why not be open to improvements and look at other yatras, how they're doing things, and take a few ideas, you know. So, I mean, it's not that, you know, as I said, it's not that I want to, you know, have some fanatic thing there of this and the only way. Oh, well, to be honest, it just pains me to see how devotees come and how devotees go. It does pain me, you know. And
I'm
not sure, you know.
We don't have that problem. I can say it quite frankly. We don't have the problem with the bloody system.
I think we have the problem all over the world.
Yeah, but that's only in other places, maybe. But, you know, you've got to be careful about... You've got to preach according to time, place, and circumstance. And seriously, you know, when the bloodies come here, they come and they stick. I can say that quite honestly. Seriously, you know, that... Because you do look after the devotees, I think. You know, I don't like being told. See, because, you know, the Bhakti Riksha devotees, they carry, you know, everything has to be converted to Bhakti Riksha.
It's just Shravanam Kirtanam, you know, that's all it is, whether you call it Bhakti Riksha or this or that. You know.
We have certain principles that we embrace. That's what we encourage. The form will be different all over the world. Where it manifests, it's different. We have to allow the local people, the local structures, they'll naturally develop themselves. Some communities will move in one direction, other communities will work in another way. If it's successful, then it'll be like that. It will naturally grow like that. Thalpa wasn't so emphatic that things had to be done in a specific way, you know, like here. He would encourage the devotees to take inspiration from different locations, but they're allowed to then do it the way they want to do it.
Just a couple of points.
I know that this temple actually has a reputation for looking after things. And my Guru Dev says, you know, any religion should be looked after the ladies very nicely. And I've actually seen it practically, you know. I've seen one guy who's so much trouble. And, you know, so much reluctance was there to actually, like, stomp on it, just because it didn't want to just damage that person's devotional paper, even though it was getting strangled by weeds. Just want to be so careful, you know, about not doing that. And that definitely is a quality I've noticed that I've been afraid of here, but I have noticed that. And also, I think, you know, perhaps the controversy arises when, you know, we say the council like system, and that probably has to be some kind of, you know, thing going around and you just turn it on. I can see that you're talking about some abstract principles of caring, you know, providing shelter. And this is the whole thing. And I think, you know, that is definitely developing in my experience, you know, even in Israel, you know, we're trying to apply the same things. I know I'm learning from David, so I'm just taking those principles, trying to apply them, you know, with mental systems and just giving guidance and encouraging that culture. Because it's a cultural thing, you know, looking after one another. But when you start saying it has to be the system, I think that's where the controversy arises. Mm-hmm. But the abstract principle of caring, you know, that's what it's really about. And, you know, I've got this mantra that I got from my Guru, the needs of the individual come before the needs of the institution. Because ultimately, in the long run, that serves the institution.
That's right, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm also, you know, when somebody says, you've got to do it, and you hear this counselor system, it sounds like, you know, something that, you know, you just plug in and turn on, you know, it's already. But you've got to apply it to the. Personally, if somebody says you have, you know, this is your counselor, I know, I've read the book, I know it's not designed like that. But if it's too systemized, too official and institutionalized, I think it loses all its potency. Of course, I know that's the arrangement's fine in this book that says that's not how it works anymore.
That's right.
It's a natural thing. I don't think that's the controversy yet. System.
I think they were kind of burned after the Bhakti Vriksha experience as well, like we mentioned that, and they kind of took that fully functioning system or setup that they had, and then they turned it into a pre-gated book, and you were just supposed to just, yeah, you know, like you said, unwrap it and turn it on. But it wouldn't work in other places the same way, because in the places where it was working, it had developed and evolved, just like Prabhu said, according to the local environment, and people had bought into the idea and developed along with it, and that was what was making it successful. So when you took the end product and said, oh, hey, look at this, it's something that had grown in place. And then they took the end product fully formed and said, oh, you just, you know, make this work here, but didn't have any of the evolutionary kind of support that had taken place in the
outside. Well, you had resistance from some people who had already another system that they were finding getting results, and they just didn't want to change what they were doing. They were getting good results, but they didn't want to change what they were doing just because somebody else said this is not that that wasn't a good idea necessarily, just they had something that was already working.
Well, I mean, as far as I understand, the system is only there in order to reach out to those who might not naturally be part of it. You know, it's just like even, you know, in one sense you can say even with accepting guru, you know, it's also a most natural thing. If you want to make advancement, you look for somebody who, you know, to take shelter. But still, that we have developed a proper system in order to really include everybody, because for some it might be the most natural thing, but then for some it might not, you know. And some might just need a bit more extra stimulus in order to come up, you know. So, you know, of course, you know, we can't just develop the system by just, you know, calling it the system and here it is, you know. With every system, if you want to have it nice, that it needs some time to develop and to function and so on, you know.
Yeah. Really, it's sort of people.
Yeah.
Individual people buying into it and saying, yeah, I'm going to do this and apply it according to the local culture and requirements.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, what you're doing is talking about it, You know, that's the first step. You know, raising awareness. That's maybe we need to do more of that. And then it will develop in its own way.
See, because one part of spiritual culture is to associate on that basis of Shravan and Kirtanam. You know, and this is the basis of the council system too, that you meet regularly, that the senior devotees, the counselors, they meet regularly for program. They develop strong affectionate relationships on that basis of Shravan and Kirtanam. So, and the problem is we Western devotees, it's not in our blood. You know, we don't meet so easily. I mean, the Indian devotees, they have that in the blood. You know, that culture aspect of meeting for Shravanam Kirtanam. There's six Bhakti Viksha groups who meet regularly, but the Western Grihasthas, they don't.
So they must be married, they are coming. I think that what they said, there's validity in what they say. But you take, you're overgeneralizing a fact, something that you see. There is good, and there's also stuff that can be greatly improved. There are some who feel greatly supported, and there are many others who feel unsupported. There are some who integrate in the temple and others who feel marginalized, and there's room for a lot of improvement all around. And also, yes, it's important, I suppose, we talk about the whole system. The Prabhupada also born again the half a chicken sort of theory, half a chicken sort of adoption. I think it's worthwhile examining it, looking at where we are, looking at what gaps there are, and seeing what improvements can be made if the system is, you know, too dark to implement it.
So I mean, once again, I want to apologize. You know, if all I want to do is offer some humble service to the devotees, this is really the only intention I'm having. You know, because after all, Anirudha Prabhu, he invited me to Melbourne to come and do my chemotherapy here. So I mean, this is, and naturally, I feel indebted. And all I want to do is just inspire the devotees and share whatever little experience I have. So I'm really sorry, you know, if I'm coming across like this, that I just want to...
If you're not controversial, you're not a brahmin.
Anyway, my humble apology, Pramudhi.
Sure.
Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki.
No.